We welcome back to the program our friend, author Colin Fleming. Check out his great books. He's written a ton of them, at least eight, many more in the pipeline, including the wonderful Sam Cooke, Live at the Harlem Square Club, 1963. If You Brackets, Fabula, Fantasy, Effery, and Hope. Colin Fleming with us. Hello there, Colin.
You're back to the conjunction, Kimball. I thought we had learned you on this. There's no and, but it's fine. You have a lot to remember and a lot to get through.
Yeah, and I wasn't cheating. I didn't have any notes. I was just winging it there.
Yeah, well, we all have our down days.
It's not a down day. This is a banner day. I don't have down days. I refuse to accept down days. I'm like you. I'm a Zulu warrior of the mind.
Oh, okay. It helps to qualify that sometimes.
Yeah, you have the...
You're not in across the board.
No. I mean, you have
like
the...
compartmentalized.
Physical component. I'm like, yeah, I can just block stuff out that I don't care about. Move
so
on.
You could be like a Zulu warrior of flossing, for instance.
I wish my dentist would like it if I would be that, but no, I'm not that. It's a very limited sphere, but, you know, I pick my area and try to shine right there if I can. Well, it's our favorite time of year, autumn here, autumn everywhere. Can we set the tone, Kerry, with a little music to lead into Colin here? Everybody and their sister has recorded a version of Autumn in New York, but what makes Charlie Parker's version stand out to you?
Listen to that tone, Kimball. Mm. Can't hear that? That's remarkable.
Oh, it's amazing.
Like, when I first heard Charlie Parker, it wasn't this. It was like Coco, like the fast bop stuff. And it just was that lightning bolt, the same lightning bolt that I remember experiencing with Hendrix. And when you played that right there, it's the lightning bolt all over again. This was quite radical at the time that alto saxophonist Mr. Parker would record with strings. It's funny. Side note, I had an editor, and he thought that Charlie Parker was a laughable musician. He's a pretty smart guy. He also thought like the Beatles were the worst band that had ever been. And he was sort of a contrarian, this person, but I could tell that he actually believed that. And so I was thinking of him when Charlie Parker entered there, because it's all about that entrance. And then the tone, it just takes over. How do you compete with a tone like that? So it's interesting that someone could hear that and think, bah, he sucks.
And I've only been to New York in the autumn, maybe two or three times in my life, but I hear that. And I'm there. I'm instantly transported. And in a timeless sense, that it's not remembering the times I was there. It's just I can feel like I'm in New York in the autumn, any time in the last 70 or 80 years.
You've hit upon something there. When a work of art makes us feel like we have prior experiences in a place we've not been. A place in this a very specific place, autumn, like you said, in New York, because I would imagine you've been to New York, right? Probably at some point. But autumn in New York, autumn in Boston, and that's what Charlie Parker gives us here. We feel that we are perpetually in this place that he is conjuring with his horn. And so it's the horn that's going to make the entire endeavor recording with strings work. And this particular person I mentioned really hated the recordings with strings. I think he thought they were soupy and syrupy. And oftentimes in jazz, when there are strings, we need to have some concern. Like Billie Holiday would be almost drowned out at times by these arrangements with strings. But that's not the case with Charlie Parker, because that horn rises above everything. So it's like quintessential in autumn sound. And you're right, everybody has recorded this, it seems. Your man Fraser Crane sang a version of it.
That's right.
Fraser. It was on Cheers, right?
Right.
And when he was at his posh Beacon Hill pad so later seasons there. But yeah, it's something that I don't just listen to it at autumn, but, and I don't even primarily associate it only with autumn. It's like this overriding autumnness that is like this land of fall that I kind of always want to go to. I wish we could just override the weather and make it like October 4th year-round.
I'm with you on that. When was that version recorded?
Oh, he did all these versions with strings in the middle of his career. So he's done all of his frantic kind of bebop stuff, and he's recording for Verve. And Norman Granz is an important figure in jazz who really worked, like he had these original ideas and would allow other people to develop their original ideas. So he might pair you with strings, or if you were Art Tatum, he'd say, Art, come into the studio and we will record you just by yourself. And then the next day we'll get like these musicians that no one would think you'd ever play with, and we'll record you with them, and we'll keep changing the lineup. And for Billie Holiday, when she was being drowned out by those strings, it was Norman Granz who said, Lady Day, let's get rid of the strings. So it's flexible depending upon the artist. And he returned to the small group environment, which is really how she sounds best. So Charlie Parker, Norman Granz, and there you go. There are a lot of other recordings in this particular pocket of sound. And I would recommend that anyone go and check them out. Maybe it's not where you start with Charlie Parker, but you will return to them often.
We're talking with Colin Fleming on Downtown. Let's go to a wonderful marriage of terrific animation and jazz. It's The Great Pumpkin, Charlie Brown, and a new release of the soundtrack. And this is, I guess, the way the creators intended it to be heard.
There were all these reels that were discovered fairly recently. And so prior to this release, which is kind of a big deal, that might sound silly. Like, how can a soundtrack from a television special from the mid-60s be a big deal? But I don't know. I feel like it's a big deal. But when you listen to this previously, you either just got it from the show, or there was this version that was ripped, like, right from, like, the TV. Mm. Sounded like it was ripped from, like, a VHS version. So the sound was dodgy and crackly and poppy, but it was also, like, the sound effects. So when I said, like, when we say soundtrack, we usually think that that means like the music or the score, but the soundtrack itself is actually like, there's Charlie Brown tripping over a pumpkin, like doink, that's in there. So all of that was in there. This is a strange listening experience. Now, because of these discovered reels, this material has come out in definitive fashion, and you don't have any of the crackles and the pops, and you get multiple versions, different attempts at takes, at, like, for instance, Linus and Lucy. And Linus and Lucy, I don't know. Like, when I think of the best known song ever produced in this country, the most instantly recognizable, I think it's Linus and Lucy. So it's quite compelling to hear these different attempts at this song that all of us know more than we know. When you hear that, da-dun-dun-dun-dun, everyone recognizes that. And I don't know, like, what else you could really say that about.
And it's a very different version than we're accustomed to on a Charlie Brown Christmas.
It is, but you would get these performances, and the melodies would come back. They might be in different keys. It was like the Peanuts approach to Fugue. But the one that we know, the Linus and Lucy that we know, is especially, it's really the province of the pumpkin. It's The Great Pumpkin, Charlie Brown, the Halloween special. And again, it's sort of like Charlie Parker. It just sounds like autumn. It's not a dirge. It's not a downer of any kind. And, like, I don't know, it almost sort of captures the sun when it's starting to go down, but it's still up there doing its sun thing. So what time is that? Like 4:30 around there? It's like, hey, I'm still really active up here. Look at me, but I'll be going down soon. But I'm still pretty joyous right now. That's what I feel this song is about, and it's just perfect too for these siblings and their particular dynamic.
And I loved Snoopy and the Leaf, and just hearing that short little piece of music drove me to go back and watch the special again. And we've talked about it before. I think it's highly underrated. Now, I've got such a soft spot in my heart for Charlie Brown Christmas, but I'm not sure it's the Great Pumpkin. Charlie Brown isn't the best of all of them.
Oh, I definitely think it is. They had figured out a lot of what they wanted to do. It was less rushed, less by the seat of the short pants, if you will. And it's a perfect special, perfect work of art, perfect work of entertainment. And it's so driven by imagination. You have, of course, Linus and this faith he has in the Great Pumpkin. And we've talked about that before, but also Snoopy and his imagination that he thinks he was this pilot in World War One. So like the quote-unquote fantasy sequence, the canine fantasy sequence where he's been downed and everything and he's making his way. There's like that smooth edit where the worlds come together when he arrives at the party. But I know the sequence you're talking about when the leaf is coming down and Snoopy is kind of like, and there's like a flute. And that's when Charlie Brown shows up on the scene and like witnesses this. It's like, oh, hello, old pal. And in that kind of like monosyllabic, like weird in tone voice that works, really works. The voice actors were so important. So you get all those details. And when you hear a soundtrack like this, you should see those visuals in your mind if you want to. It's not like they're a distraction. And we can certainly do that if you're in the mood.
What's interesting to me is I watched it, and it had been, I don't know, maybe 2 or 3 years since I had seen it. You're used to that world not having any adults in it. But it's even a bit more shocking, I guess, now, because the thought of sending kids out on their own trick-or-treating, no self-respecting parent would dare do that in this day and age. And yet that's what made the time so special for those kids and any of us lucky enough to grow up at that time.
I would. If I breed, Kimball, my kids are going out like that. That's what's going to happen. I'm going to take this radical new approach to parenting, the Sea Dog approach. So that's going to be something that I am going to instill in them. But we almost get adults in this. They're just off stage
right
when the candy is given out. So presumably, an adult has tossed that rock into Charlie Brown's back. We don't know. I guess it could be like some mean-spirited 7-year-old who had the measles and couldn't go out. And she's like, screw you, try that back. something like that. Or Snoopy disapproves of her. But who knows? But it's like this primal world of kids. I don't want to say it's like Lord of the Flies. But I like the spookiness of it, too. And that's in the soundtrack that it's Halloween-y.
Yeah.
The classic. I don't like this. Oh, I'm dressing up as, I don't know, name somebody, Kimball. Britney Spears or
right.
Stephen A. Smith, right? No, you're a ghost. You're a goblin. You're Dracula. You're the Frankenstein monster. And they have those classic costumes at the beginning. Like, even when I see those early scenes and even just like the title cards at the start, I'm ready to go.
Oh, yeah.
I'm ready to get the Lugosi cape. And, like, hopefully I score some Twixes, and it all goes the way I want it to. But, I love it. Perfect work of art and entertainment. And we don't have many that fit both of those bills at the same time.
Speaking of a great work of art and entertainment, and one that taps into, well, as you pointed out in your message, ancient rituals, Shakespeare's Macbeth.
Yes, I was thinking about for our early autumn tour, The Song of the Witches. So people know it as the double-double toil and trouble bit. And it really is this classic scene setting worthy of fall. And I think it's so taken for granted now that there are all these sort of pop culture references to it. And I'm sure the people who the references are being made to have never read Macbeth. It's just one of those things that is suffused in culture. Like when we see an expression, for instance, and I'll be a son of a gun. Well, you don't really hear that much anymore, but you know what I mean. And there's always like this origin story for that. You probably know the origin story for that one, being a man of the sea yourself. But I feel like Song of the Witches has become that way. And when we look at it, it's just so spooktacular, right? Very short. Double, double, toil and trouble, fire burn and cauldron bubble. Fillet of a fenny snake in the cauldron boil and bake. Eye of newt and toe of frog, wool of bat and tongue of dog. Adder's fork and blind worm sting, lizard's leg and howlet swing. For a charm of powerful trouble, like a hell broth, boil and bubble. Double, double, toil and trouble, fire burn and cauldron bubble. Cool it with a baboon's blood, then the charm is firm and good. Kimball, I might have just cursed both of them.
Yeah. I've got to leave the building and circle it three times backwards just to protect us.
But you hear, like, besides the sing-song, the lilt of it all, think of what is in this sort of, like, hunted gazpacho. We have a blind worm sting. So it's like the ghost. Like, it's not actually a thing. You know what I'm saying? It's not like a corporeal object that, like, hey, I can touch this. But the actual sting is in there. I love that. It's like, way to go, Shakespeare. That's so witty that you could put that into your farrago. And we have the classic setup of witches, and they're stirring, and they're up to no good, and you don't want to mess with them, but maybe they have some info that you could use. Would you even want to know it? I mean, I don't know. If I all of a sudden could tell you right now, Richard Kimball, the very day on which you're going to die, would you want to know?
La, 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 no.
No, you're not into that. You want me to just put it to you in, like, one of our Facebook?
Sure, that's better. Yeah, that's fine. That's where I want to learn right there, yeah.
I'll just shoot that over, yeah. So that's what's going on here, but it's like the classic witch setup, and I know you're supposed to think, like, New England and witches, and there was that really boring film that came out a few years ago, but I'd like a good, like, sort of Scottish witch with a brew and some predictions.
And I like it, too, when it's played straight, and I think sometimes, in particularly in amateur Shakespeare productions, the witches are used as a little bit of comic relief. And I like it when it's a little bit darker.
It's very dark at the beginning of Orson Welles' Macbeth. It sets the tone early on that we're in a horror film for the most part. And going along there with, like, Banquo, it's the screen is clouded over. It looks, speaking of primordial, it looks like we've all emerged from the ooze to be witnessing this particular scene with these witches. They're hideous. And yet he's tempted. He's going to seek them out, and he's going to get the information that you are loath to have. And just sort of a classic autumn set. Like, this isn't something I feel that happens on July 2nd. Like, this has to be, like, in fall. It's not in winter. Like, you can't even conceive of there being snow around while this is occurring.
Right.
And you also can't, like, conceive of there being much greenery on the surrounding trees. You need, like, those sort of skeletal trees.
Yeah, with the dried leaves blowing around.
Yeah. Something's crunching under your feet, but nothing under their feet. And then you're like, oh, is it because they're not stirring that much? Are they so supernatural? What am I going to do? Let's see what they have to say.
You took me back, my friend, as I watched something I don't think I've seen since I was maybe 7 or 8 years old, the wonderful Ray Harryhausen, and I didn't realize it was from 1951, The Story of Hansel and Gretel. Wow, was that something that caught me when I was a little goober?
You probably didn't realize it was from 1951 because it just played in the theater, because that's how I saw it, and that would have been like 1980 circa. I remember I went with my dad. So it was one of those things that must have just played for a lot of decades on Saturday afternoons for parents taking their rainy kids, their kids out of the house on, like, rainy days, right? It must have been that. And I remember it was just me and my dad. It was kind of like a strange thing for us to go to. We weren't, like, zipping around to the cinema together that often, but he took me to that. And of course, it scared the bejesus out of me.
Oh, yeah.
Because of, it's the movement, isn't it? It's the look of the thing. I mean, it's weird to say.
It's
Hansel and Gretel.
And it's the eyes, too.
Anyway.
The eyes of those characters. Ooh.
Yeah, and Hansel and Gretel isn't, like, comfort food for, like, the reading or theatrical experience. Talking about... And you might be thinking, like, is this getting him to rethink his policy for Halloween if he breeds, the whole like Hansel and Gretel effect? No, I would say sometimes life just happens, and it did one day for Hansel and Gretel. It worked out okay in the end,
sure.
And I bet you they got tougher for it. But this, it's like the claymation or the animagic, if you're like a Rankin Bass fan, and it will just disturb you without trying to disturb you quite the way it does. It wants to disturb you with the story, but not disturb you with like, egad, what are these beings on the screen? Which is how it does disturb you.
Yeah, it's stunning. And you can check it out online, the story of Hansel and Gretel. Finally, today, we talk hot chocolate, all things hot chocolate. And, well, where do you come from in the world of hot chocolate? What does it do for you? What memories does it invoke?
I feel like hot chocolate represents more than a drink. Would you agree?
Oh, gosh, yes.
A lot of drinks are just drinks. Like water is a drink. When you are pounding your stouts at night, right? Getting all like looped up and everything. It's just a drink. But there's something that is symbolically warming about hot chocolate. Like I was coming back when you phoned. I was not going to get a hot chocolate because I didn't feel like I deserved one today. I didn't perform the way that I wanted to. But that's sort of how I look at hot chocolate. Had I performed the way I wanted to, or endured and needed some kind of like pick-me-up, I would have gotten that hot chocolate, and it just would have been a restorative. And that's sort of what like hot chocolate is in different forms, not like grim as it might be with my life. But when you're a kid and you're out there and you're sledding and it's cold, or you're coming back from Halloween trick-or-treating, you're looking forward to that hot chocolate. It's like this special kind of privatized drink of much and rewarding symbolism. And it represents safety. It represents a bouncing back. It represents a pick-me-up. It represents something that someone made for you because it would pick you up and they care about you. So it's like a very affectionate and like sort of lovingly related drink. And there really aren't a lot like that.
No, and I can't think of many other things that you found comforting in childhood that can still be as comforting today.
I agree. And it's like, it seems that adults don't have hot chocolate unless their kids are having it and whatever. I rarely at the Starbucks see anyone else order a hot chocolate. It can be like a dark day in winter. And it seems like when it is dark so early and it's like Sunday night and I don't know, it's like 6:30 and you're in there. That would be a time to get the hot chocolate, but no one does. I feel like people want to represent themselves a certain way with everything. And the hot chocolate is like this drink of childhood, but that's not a bad thing. There are lots of things that are from childhood that we should retain to be successful and healthy adults, a capacity for wonder, a desire for play, a need to ask questions. These are all things that we have as children that often like sort of flake away as we get older. And the restorative and the pick-me-up and making the hot chocolate for someone we care about, those are things that we can have at 30, 40, 50, 60. I mean, I certainly look at it that way.
And I won't turn down someone who wants to steam the milk and perhaps a special cocoa, maybe with some little chili powder or something, but if I really want to be comforted, if I really want that childhood sense of reward, open up that packet of Swiss Miss, and yes, if you've got mini marshmallows, I will take them.
Wait, what's going on here? Milk and chili powder? Is this like, is this a thing?
Oh, the high-end cocos that some people enjoy.
Oh, so you're moving out of my pay grade with talk of that nature.
Well, that's why, like I'm not going to turn them down, but my preference is heat the water and pour in the Swiss Miss, stir it up, and if there are clumps in it, yes, by God, that's what I came for.
Oh, right. The clumps are not, yeah, that's nothing to feel that no, I enjoy a good clump and sort of like chomping down on those.
Yes.
It's no fat. It's skim milk. I get the skim milk version, and I don't get the whipped cream because, you know, I have my Zulu standard, and I'm not by any stretch like a sweet tooth person. I'm not like someone who has to devour cakes and candies and all that stuff. So this is kind of like my main indulgence, but it doesn't have to be that cool out for me to order the hot chocolate if I think I've earned it at the Starbucks. Like, July is not really a hot chocolate friendly month, but when we get into August, people tend not to know this about August, but pay attention next year, you listeners. Fall starts creeping into August. The humidity goes away, and fall's like, let me in, bitches. It's almost my time. It's like, yeah, I hear you, fall. I'll open that door. And then, like, come September this year, summer just went away completely,
yeah.
And then it was cool. It was light jacket weather, and of course I was getting those hot chocolates when I deserved them.
If you have a little left as you get home, do you toast Hallway Hermie with your hot chocolate cup?
Oh, he is I wouldn't even say recovering alcoholic, but he's always in his cups. So that's just one of the things that you have to accept. Oh, so there are these people, speaking of in your cups, there are these people coming up the stairs the other day, my building's become like almost like a dorm, and all these meatheads in the building. And because of Hallway Hermie and my setup, my gourds outside, I'm at the desk working, people make comments. So I actually have to put my fingers in my ears so I don't have to hear the rude things people say defaming me and my elf and everything out there, my setup, my books, my gourds, because then I'm going to throw open the door in a Zulu rage, and you know that's not good for anyone.
No.
But I've heard comments like, what's wrong with this guy? Why does he have an elf? So none of us like that, me or Hallway Hermie, but I do take the hot chocolate and I put it in the refrigerator. Because even better than regular hot chocolate, it's cold hot chocolate. But then that means you have to earn it in the morning.
It's a beautiful thing, any way you slice it. Colin Fleming with us here on Downtown. Thank you, my friend. We'll check in again next Tuesday.
All right, sounds good.